I'd like to begin with Daniel chapter 7 and verse 7. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, the fourth beast, dreadful, terrible, terrifying, and extremely strong. And it had iron teeth. It devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the other beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. 10 horns. Now, the only place that you have 10 horns referred to a beast is the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 13, you have a beast with 10 horns. And here, if you'll read with me, Revelation chapter 13. The dragon stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea, having 10 horns, so here's the same 10 horns, and 7 heads. So it was not just one head, but 7 heads, and on the horns, 10 diadems, and on the heads were blasphemous names. Blasphemy is against God. The beast which I saw was like a leopard. Now, look at the composite. Like a leopard, his feet were like those of a bear. The mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon, which is Satan, which we saw in chapter 12, Satan, gave him his power and his throne and great authority. I saw one of his heads as it were slain, and a fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. Well, yeah, it wouldn't be amazed, because it was the beast power that killed the two witnesses that couldn't be killed by any other power. They worshiped the dragon because he gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast because, saying, here's how they worship the beast. Who is like the beast? Who is like it? You know, we say this about God. Who is like God? But they're going to say, who is like the beast, and who is able to make war with him? Well, he conquered the two witnesses. Nobody can make war with a beast like that. There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies. Against blasphemies or against God. And authority to act for 42 months was given to him, and he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God. Here it is in verse 6. To blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, and that those who dwell in heaven, and those who dwell in heaven, that means his angels, the spirits, the elders around the seraphim, whatever this is, blasphemy, everything. It was given to him to make war with the saints. Now, here he comes after God's people. It's always these beasts are after God's people, and to overcome them, authority over every tribe, people, and tongue, and nation was given to him. All who dwell on the earth will worship him. Everyone whose name is not found in written in the foundation of the world, the world in the book of life of the Lamb who has been slain. Now, in verse 11, I want you to notice carefully, this is Revelation 13, verse 11. Then I saw another beast. Okay, so we already have one beast. One beast is coming where? Out of the sea. You see that in verse 2, Revelation 13? The other beast here. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. And he had 2 horns like a lamb. He spoke like the dragon, like the devil. He exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. And he makes the earth and those who dwell in it worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. He performs great signs so that even he makes fire come down from heaven onto the earth in the presence of men. So here's this great power. Verse 14, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which were given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come back to life. Two very powerful beasts. Where do we find anything like this in the Bible? I want you to go back with me to the book of Job. And I'm going to read from Job chapter 40, beginning in verse 15. Now he's talking to Job, and Job thinks, you know, Job said, questioning God, well, you know, why are you doing this to me? And God's going to try to show Job, you know, you don't know that much. You don't know all my plans. You don't understand. Now, it wasn't Job's fault. Job wasn't self-righteous. I don't believe that for a minute. Job was just trying to do the right thing, but when everything came on him and everybody was accusing him, and he said, I just wish God would come down here and tell me what's going on. I wish God would explain this to me, how I, doing all these things, could be suffering for sins that I never committed and so on. Now he's telling him all the things that you don't understand the thunder, you don't understand this. And in verse 15, he tells, this is Job 40, verse 15, behold now Behemoth, 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 which I made as well as you. Okay, I made you. I made this behemoth. He eats grass like an ox. Behold now his strength in his loins. Look how powerful he is. And his power is in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. Now, I know this is poetic language. It's in the book of Job. Poetic language. Okay, but let's read it. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Now, listen to this. Let his maker bring near his sword. The only person, the only power able to destroy or find or conquer this behemoth is God. God made him. God can bring the sword near. Let his maker bring near the sword. None of the rest of us can do it. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the fields play there. Under the lotus plants he lies down. In the covert of the reeds and marsh, the lotus plants cover him with shade, and the willows of the brook surround him. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. He is confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he is on the watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? Can you even do it to him? Here is a beast so powerful. Now, this is a land animal. It's a land animal that only God will slay. And in verse 19, you see that? He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Now, the Septuagint version of this uses the Greek word for this beast as therion. The same Greek word, it means a wild beast. It's not a tame beast. It cannot be a tame beast. Therion is the Greek word for beast. The same word that's used in the book of Revelation for beast. You saw this beast come out. It's a therion. Okay? It means a wild beast, and it's not tame. So you have to compare verses 10 of Revelation and verse 14 of Revelation. Now, in Revelation, you remember, it said, I saw another beast coming out of the earth. So this is an earth beast. The first beast that Job is told about is an earth beast. You see, I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns and spoke like a lamb. He exercised all the authority. We just read that. In verses 13 and 14, he performs all the signs. He deceives those who dwell on the earth. This is some power. This is not a regular animal. This is not an animal. This is not a real animal that we have out here. Now, the second beast in Job starts in chapter 41 of Job. Chapter 41 of Job, and beginning in verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan? with a fish hook. Now here is a sea beast. Or press his tongue with a cord. Can you put a hook in it and tie down? They used to tie down big fish, you know, snouts around. They put it tied down. Can you do that? Can you put a rope in his nose? Or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he plead, please don't hurt me? Please don't. No, he's not going to. Or will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you, agreement? Okay, I won't hurt you if you won't hurt me. Will you take him for a servant forever? You're gonna make him your servant. You're gonna harness him. You know, humans have harnessed elephants. We have harnessed even some lions have been trained in different things. We've harnessed them a little bit, but God is saying, can you do this to Leviathan? No. Will you play with him as with a bird? You know, we've harvested, we can train a falcon to go out and capture other birds and capture other things and bring them. Or will you bind him for your maidens? Will the traders bargain over him? Hey, here's a great big sea monster. Would you like to have him? No. Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons? Or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle, in the battle you will not do it again. If you lay your hand on him, you will not do it again. Behold, your expectation is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? He's so vicious at the sight of him. It's just like Daniel said, I saw this beast. I was terrified. No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Now, think of that. Humans have conquered almost every animal there is. We can wipe out almost any species completely. But no one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? Can stand before him. There's a word me, but it could be me or him. It's in italics. Who has given to me, though now he's talking about God, to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine, God says, and I will not keep silence. So here we have, I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. God is, this beast is so powerful. Rhetorical questions, you know, will you make supplication? Will you speak soft words? When he raises himself up in the mighty because of the crashing, they are bewildered in verse 25 of verse. See this? When he raises himself up, the mighty fear, Leviathan raises himself, because of the crashing, they are bewildered. Researchers and commentators have tried to say, this is some kind of beast. We're trying to figure out, is it a whale? Is it a whale that's big enough? Is it a big shark? Is the behemoth is it one of those rhinoceroses? Is it an elephant? What is it? What is the behemoth? What is this? We're trying to nail it down to a physical animal. And let me read verse 25 in the New English Translation. When it rises up, the mighty are terrified. At its thrashing about, they withdraw. Now here's what the Septuagint version of this verse 25 says. There is nothing on earth like him, formed to be sported with by angels. What is the Septuagint translation? Septuagint translation was done way before the birth of Christ, somewhere in about 170 BC. It was a translation of the Hebrew into Greek. Now, I want to tell you something about the Hebrew of the book of Job. The Hebrew of the book of Job is very, very difficult. Think in Hebrew in general. Hebrew is not an easy language. Rabbis later put in vowel points, but the original Hebrew had no vowel points. The original Hebrew that was written early had no vowel points. It was just consonants. Maybe some of you have watched, what is that, Wheel of Fortune? And they show you a lot of letters here. And you know, can you guess what that phrase is? They even tell you the hint. They hint you the phrase. It's about this or it's about that. And then you say, somebody says, well, can I buy an E? Yeah, there are four E's, okay? Can I buy an I? And then you may stab at it. Very hard to understand a word that has no vowels. So that's why the Hebrew language has been very difficult and sometimes ambiguous. So here in the book of the Septuagint, which is the Greek, the way the rabbis understood that Hebrew and they translated it, in some cases interpreting it in the Greek. Now here's how they interpret verse 25. Your translation says, when he raises up the mighty fear because of the crashing, they are bewildered. Here's the Septuagint. There is nothing on earth like him. Formed. He is formed to be sported with by angels. Why would you be sported with by angels? This is some kind of spiritual being, some kind of thing that is not in the physical realm. Remember, verse 19, only God can beat him. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Let me read that in the New English Translation. It ranks first among the works of God. The one who made it has furnished it with a sword. Now that's how difficult the book of Job is to try to get an absolute good translation. Here is verse 19 in the New International Version. It, meaning this Leviathan, ranks first, this behemoth, ranks first among the works of God, yet its maker can approach it with his sword. Here is the New Jerusalem Bible. He is the first of the works of God. His maker threatened him with the sword. Here is the Septuagint version of Job 40 and verse 19. This is the chief of the creation of the Lord, made to be played with by the angels. Now that's different from Job 41 talking about Leviathan, but Behemoth is also said to be made to be played with by the angels. So these chapter and verses in Job allude to the pre-flood defeat of the dragon by God, but it implies yet a future battle. You'll see it in verses chapter 40, verse 19, 24, chapter 24 and verse 24, chapter 41 and verse 25. He raised himself up, the mighty fear because of the crashing. They are bewildered, and the sword that reaches him cannot prevail. Cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into rubble. Clubs are regarded as stubble. He laughs at the rattling of a javelin. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads out, and so on. So here is a being, if you read all through Job, here is a being that is not normal. It's not in the realm of our world. And here is Job chapter 7, verse 12. Am I the sea or the creature of the deep that you must put me under guard? Under guard? Am I the creature of the deep? So though the beast was defeated, he continues to exist and is subdued in a subdued condition. Job 7, verse 12. Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? New American Standard Version. Am I the sea or the sea monster that you set a guard over me? Now, this is the New English translation of that same verse. Am I the sea or the creature of the deep that you must put me under guard? Satan was put under guard for 1,000 years. Do you remember? thousand years in the book of Revelation? I'm going to read Amos chapter 9 and verse 3. Though they hide on the summit of Carmel, I will search them out and take them from there. Though they conceal themselves from my sight on the floor of the sea, from there I will command the serpent and it will bite them. This is God saying, the evil people of Israel, hey, you can't run from God. But notice that if they go to the floor of the sea, the serpent will get them there. This is not a normal animal. This is not a physical animal. Now, Jewish tradition assumed that the beginning, you know, that the beginning of history was to be recapitulated at the end of history. The tradition held that on the fifth day of creation, this is Jewish tradition now, they held that on the fifth day of creation, God created Leviathan to be in the sea. And he also created Behemoth to be on the land. These two beasts were symbolic of the powers of evil and were to be destroyed in the final judgment. What are the beasts going to happen? What are the beasts going to do in the chapter 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 and 17 of the book of Revelation and 18? They're going to be destroyed in the final judgment. Almost without exception, the image of the sea monster is used throughout the Old Testament to represent evil kingdoms who persecuted God's people. See Revelation 12, the dragon. What does the dragon do? It's a sea monster, the dragon, you know? It's coming after God's people. The dragon of Revelation 12 is seen as the ultimate force behind all the earthly kingdoms of the world. Well, what did Satan say to Jesus? Look, you want to be over all these kingdoms? Fall down and worship me, and I'll give you. I'm over the kingdoms. I control the kingdoms. Now, God is behind it. God doesn't. God allows whatever he allows. It's all under the permission of God. Nobody can thwart God. But Satan was put in charge of them, and he is the ultimate power behind these, you know, under God, ultimate power behind these earthly kingdoms. This is clear from Daniel 7 and verse 24. The 10 diadems of the beast's horn firm the reference to the earthly king or kingdoms. Now, in Daniel chapter 7, if you drop down to verse 24 of chapter 7, what does it say? As for the 10 horns out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. So the 10 horns of this beast are 10 kings. They will arise, and another will arise after them. That's that little small horn, which we haven't yet talked about in verse 8. And another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. So we know that the 10 horns are the kings there. The 10, and then they have 10 diadems on them. That's a little decoration. The difference between horns and diadems, the horns represent the king, but the diadems represent a decoration of royalty. So here's this beast. So we have this fourth beast. Horns are generally a metaphor for power, and the king has a lot of power. We saw that. Nebuchadnezzar could just destroy somebody and tell him to kill that guy and all that. So here's what we have. Chapter 7, verse 7 of Daniel, you have a fourth beast. It's the sequencing of chapter 2, the great image, and the image of gold, and then silver, and then bronze, and then this other part with the iron mixed with miry clay and so on. So this would correlate with the iron and clay of the legs of chapter 2, and then we have these other things in chapter 7 and even in chapter 8. So the fourth empire is characterized in several ways. The fourth empire, it's a fourth beast. It's got to be a fourth empire. It's characterized as dreadful, chapter 7 and verse 7. Terrifying, chapter 7, verse 7. Extremely strong, Daniel 7, verse 7. It has iron teeth. Now, in Hebrew, this could possibly be either two large teeth, it's a dual thing, or two rows of teeth, or two big, large teeth. We also know that in chapter 7 of Daniel, in verses 7 and 19, it devours. We know that it crushes in chapter 7 and verse 7 and verses 19. We know that it tramples down the remainder with its feet. Whatever it can't eat, it just tramples, stomps it. We know that it has 10 horns. We know that there's a boastful little horn that comes up from it in chapter 7 and verse 8 and also verse 20. We know that it has claws of bronze in chapter 7 and verse 19. So this is the description, claws of bronze. It's terrifying, this beast, terrifying. And now the question is, here's my question. Is it the Roman Empire? Is that what it is? Is that what this beast is? Most commentators talk about, yes, this is the Roman Empire. Yeah, the Roman Empire destroyed it. It didn't bring anything good into the world. It was a destructive force, and so on. Now, I understand that the Romans, you know, they conquered. They had a very tough army. They were dressed in red. Roman soldiers wore red, and it terrified people. You know, British soldiers adopted that same thing. That's why the redcoats are coming, the redcoats are coming. The redcoats meant the British army, but they were all British. They didn't say the British are coming because they were all British. So the redcoats, the British wore redcoats just like the Romans wore redcoats in their service. Now the armies were cruel. They conquered people. They conquered, you know, they're known for their military, political, and scientific institutions. The Romans conquered vast amounts of land in Europe and northern Africa. They built roads. They built aqueducts. They spread the Latin language, which is their language, far and wide. You know, Alexander spread his Greek language far and wide, but afterward, the Romans came in, they spread the Roman language, which was Latin, far and wide. Now, the Romans were cruel. They had cruel punishments. They used the same kind of punishments that Persia used and kingdoms before them. They used crucifixion. They would crucify people, behead people, cut their heads off, and so on. They were cruel. The armies were cruel. They conquered with power and cruelty. But can we say that Rome just destroyed everything in its path and that it was nothing good? Now, Romans did not invent drainage sewers. They did not invent the alphabet. They did not invent roads. Roads were there before them. But here's what they did do. They did develop them. They did, however, invent the underfloor heating. Under the floor heating. They did invent concrete. They did invent the calendar, which we use today. We use the Roman calendar, 365-day calendar, like the Romans. And that's why we have July inserted in the summer, because Julius Caesar wanted a month named after him of the 12 months. And they started naming most of the months by letters or numbers, and the seventh month was going to be July, but he said they turned it into July was going to be the seventh month. And then the eighth month was going to be August. But Augustus Caesar said, I want August to be named after me, Augustus. So we have August after him. Then September, what does it mean? 7. October, 8. November, 9. December, 10. But December ends up being the 12th month. November, the 9th, becomes the 11th month. October, the 8th, becomes the 10th month, and September the 7th becomes the 9th month because they inserted those two Caesars inserted themselves into the calendar. We're using the Roman calendar today. All society in the United States and Britain and most Western Europe uses the Roman calendar. That's just the way it is. They use concrete. Their concrete played a very important part in their building, allowing them to construct structures like aqueducts, and they used arches, you know, the arch to for bridges and so on, which was stronger than most things, and we use a lot of that to this day. Ancient Romans have had a tremendous impact on art and architecture. We can find traces of the Roman influence in forms of structures throughout the development of the Western world, even to this day. Romans were heavily influenced, however, by the Greeks. They were able to make improvements in what the Greeks did and their designs and their inventions. For example, they used their columns just like Greeks did, but they formed the columns with even a more decorative and less structural for the Romans' buildings. Ancient Romans created and created the curved roofs and large-scale arches, which were able to support more weight. They used these arches to support more weight than ordinary. These arches served as the foundation for massive bridges, aqueducts that the Romans built. Now, the Romans were game-loving. You know, they loved their sports. And so to the Romans, they built large amphitheaters, including the Colosseum, which is a part of it, still stands in Rome today. The sports stadiums that we see today in their oval shape, you know, you see football stadiums in an oval shape, that they were pretty much patterned after what the Romans developed. Ancient Romans pioneered advances in many areas of science and technology. They established tools and methods that have ultimately shaped the way the world does certain things. The Romans were extremely good at engineering. They understood the laws of physics. They developed aqueducts, better ways to aid in flow water. They knew how to build expansive road networks. They built so many roads. They laid down a strong dirt foundation, and then they put stones on it, formed stones over it. It wasn't as smooth as we do today with our concrete and everything, but they formed roads all over the place, laying gravel, then paving with the rock slabs. The Romans' road system was so large, all over the known world at that time, wherever they conquered, they put roads. And the phrase came up that all roads lead to Rome. That was the phrase, because they did. All roads lead to Rome. So they had large-scale engineering projects. They developed successful farming methods, agriculture. They developed techniques for improving their farms and their crops through crop rotation, through pruning, through grafting, through seed selection, and for fertilizing with manure. They did that. The Romans also used mills to process their grains. They could grind the grains into flour. They used mills, and they improved their efficiency. And they employed many people in the production of bread and grains and the grinding of grains. Much of the literature of the world has been influenced by literature that from ancient Rome, the way they wrote their literature. And that influenced people in the areas of poets such as Virgil, Horace, Ovid, and Shakespeare especially was very impressed with the Romans. English authors such as Chaucer, Milton, and Dante from Italy. But Shakespeare loved the Roman. He was fascinated by the ancient Romans. And, of course, he wrote two giant plays, called Julius Caesar, the other one called Antony and Cleopatra. So Rome had a powerful effect. Their language has had an enormous effect on the Western world. Many of our words in the English language come from Latin. They have Latin bases. We have a lot of Greek ones too, but Latin bases. The Romance languages came from the Latin. Spanish, Italian, French, Portuguese. Some of these languages all came from the basis of the Latin languages, which were the Roman languages. The English alphabet is based on the Latin alphabet. Along with that, a lot of the Latin is still used in present-day judicial systems. For instance, our law and our way of dealing with justice in our nation is based on ancient Romans justice, and the English got it from the Romans as well. If you were accused of a crime, you had to have a court proceeding. You had first a preliminary proceeding, a preliminary hearing to determine whether or not there was a case. The magistrate of the preliminary hearing would say, well, okay, I guess there is a case here. Then we can send it to a court. Then we could go to a court where you have witnesses. And sometimes you would have a prominent person who knows the laws would argue for either the defense or the prosecution of the person. That's why the Apostle Paul, when in his time, said, well, don't you have anybody in the church that can make a judgment on this? Don't you have anybody in the, are you going to go to court in the worldly courts? Why don't you have a church member? But even in the worldly courts, the prominent people exercise positions like a lawyer in the court. They were like that. So the Romans, you know, much of the foundation of the justice system is part of what we have today in much of Europe and in the United States today. If you're a lawyer, you will know some of these words, and I'm just going to say they are Latin words. And every attorney has to learn a lot of Latin words because they don't want to take time to define it all, okay? Ad litem. Ad litem means for the suit. The courts will appoint attorneys for the suit. Generally, in the matter of law, the parties that have a legal interest in the case, but they cannot represent, if they cannot represent themselves, then the court will appoint somebody ad litem. Ad litem means he will be appointed for the suit. So a child that's part of a suit doesn't have an attorney, the court will say ad litem. Then there's amicus curiae, or an amicus brief, means a friend of the court. Amicus curiae means a friend of the court. A person who doesn't have an interest or is not actual a part of that suit can write up something for the court to listen to. I'm going to write it up as a friend of the court. I think I have information that might help the judges, the court, to decide. Then you have de novo, meaning you start a new trial. Ex parte means I'm going to do it away from the other party. I'm going to have an ex parte meeting with the judge away from the other. I don't want the other defense attorneys there. Habeas corpus, you've probably heard some of these, means you have the body. In camera means in chain, we'll go into changers. In forma paupers means in the matter of a pauper, meaning that the pauper is too poor to represent himself or have a lawyer, has to be one. And one that I use all the time in my letters when I write some, in re. In re means in the matter of. In re. It's a Latin word, in re. Mandamus. Mandamus is an order. The court gives you a mandamus that we command you to do this, a mandamus. Okay, so you have all these things. Pro bono is a Latin phrase. Pro bono means for the good. So you're doing it not necessarily for money, but for the public good. Pro se, if you do something pro se, it's for yourself. Or the phrase in pro per, means I'm going to represent myself. He's representing himself in the court, and so on. And we have a famous Latin phrase, quid pro quo, meaning this for that. All relationships based on, in psychology, we believe all relationships are based on quid pro quo, an exchange of something for something else. So did the Romans just ruin things? Citizenship in Rome was considered to be very privileged. A person who was a citizen, he had to be a free person. He couldn't be a slave. He couldn't be in prison or something. He had privileges of political and legal status that was afforded to him as an individual. It was one of the most valuable things you could get in the time that Rome ruled the world was a citizenship in Rome, for Rome. You remember the phrase when the Apostle Paul was about to be beaten? You remember they strung him out. This is Acts chapter 22. And when they stretched, I'm going to read from verse 25. When they stretched him out on thongs, they're going to pull him out, they stretched him out. Now, they're going to stretch him out on here, and then they can take a strap and they can just beat him and beat him. And Paul said to the centurion is a person over 100 men, to the centurion who was standing by, hey, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman? That means a Roman. If you said, I'm a Roman, that meant you were a citizen of Rome. That was a powerful statement. Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? I have not been tried. You're trying to beat me here? When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander immediately. The commander over, centurion wasn't the commander. He went to the commander. He told the commander, hey, this guy says he's a Roman. Is it lawful? Oh, it's not lawful. You cannot beat a Roman uncondemned. He told him, saying, what you're about to do, what are you going to do to this man? For this man is a Roman. Well, the commander comes running right away. He came to Paul and he said to you, tell me, are you a Roman? Paul said, yes. Now, why did the man believe him? Well, to say you were a Roman, if you were not, incurred the death penalty. The death penalty. That's how valuable a Roman citizenship is. Today, one of the most valuable citizenships anyone can have is to be a citizen of the United States of America. People are thronging to get that citizenship. They can't wait. They can't. I know people who, not too long ago, got their citizenship. They're so proud. My dad was proud, one of the great times of his life, proud to be an American citizen. So here was one of the things he said, well, are you a Roman? He said, yes. The commander said, oh, man, I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money. I had to pay a lot of money. Paul said, I was actually born a citizen. I was born, free-born. Just like you, if you were born in the United States, you were not a criminal, you were not something, you were born a citizen of the United States, one of the great privileges of all time. Now, the Apostle Paul did not look on Rome as a bad thing. He did not say, you know, it's just terrible. He said in Rome, in Romans chapter 13, if you remember, it's in the book of Romans chapter 13, that we ought to be subject to the higher powers. And that the power is not going to hurt you if you're obeying, if you're doing the right thing. He does not wield the sword in vain, but he won't hurt you if you're doing the right thing. The Apostle Paul said this. After the fall of Rome, the world in the European world, was plunged into the Dark Ages. The fall of Rome happened in 476, in the 5th century, and it was plunged into the Dark Ages all the way through to about the 9th century. Dark Ages meant superstition, no scientific evidence, intolerance of new ideas, intolerance of anything brought up. We're going to put you in jail if you say the earth is round. We're going to, you know, even in 1492, they thought the earth was flat. Well, other people were saying, no, it's not flat. But, you know, people would say, you're going to sail right off and fall off the edge of the earth. Even in 1492, the ignorance was still there. It was plunged into Dark Ages after Rome went down because science stopped, things stopped, and it just became silly. What happened was that the church took over, the Catholic Church took over, and they just inserted themselves into everything, and you couldn't say that this was this was science. And you remember the gentleman that said, no, the earth doesn't revolve around Copernicus from Egypt, said the sun is stable, and the earth runs around the sun, not the earth around the sun around the earth. And he was, and then Galileo took his inventions, and Galileo kept preaching that. When they was finally threatened with the Inquisition, either shut up about it, or you're going to be in the Inquisition. So we went into the Dark Ages after Rome was no longer this power. Okay, so what is that fourth beast? Is that fourth beast Rome? Is that fourth beast so terrible that it ruined the world? I don't think Rome ruined the world that badly. Something is coming. Something is coming based on these horrific beasts that are going to come at an end time, and are going to, now that Behemoth and Leviathan came in the early creation of God, but the end time beasts are going to come to finish it. What happens at the beginning is going to happen at the end, and we're going to have this cataclysmic time. And God alone is able to tame these beasts. They are made to be sported with by the angels, which means they are not physical things. This is my conclusion. Now, you may feel free to disagree with it. I'm just giving you what I have researched and what I've thought. And these are my thoughts right now. I do not think the fourth beast can be equated with Rome, even though Rome was a world-ruling empire. But I do not think it fits the description of chapter 7 and verse 7. After this, I was looking in the night visions. Behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceeding strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. So I don't think that had to do with Rome itself. I think there's something coming. We'll talk more about this in another sermon. Join me in prayer. Father in heaven, we know there are forces that want, under Satan's powers, to persecute your people, to destroy your people, but they can't. Jesus said, I will build my church and the gates of the grave will not prevail against it. And you will not let that happen. But you will let some persecution, you will let some martyrs, you will let some people give their lives, those who loved not their lives even unto death. So we thank you, Father. We just ask that you will keep us safe, that you will keep us strong, you will keep us faithful, that we will have a relationship with you because we thank you regularly. We praise you regularly. We glorify your name regularly. And we will have this wonderful relationship with you that binds us to you. In no matter what the circumstances around us. So thank you, Father. We pray for those who are sick, who are injured, who need your help. We ask you to hear their prayers, our brothers and sisters that we love so much. We ask you to comfort the bereaved. We ask you to help them through these difficult times that they face. We thank you for every blessing now, and we praise your holy name in the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. We give you all the glory. Amen. Well, that's it for today. Have a wonderful Sabbath wherever you are, wherever you're doing. Be safe and careful, and we look forward to seeing a number of you at the feast. Okay? Take care now. Bye-bye. Testing.